Gold Rush. In the summer of 2001, 2 months before the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, the Department of Defense officially launched its drive to revive bioweapons research by sending a report to Congress, authored by Kadlec, pleading that the military system for developing vaccines to protect troops from anthrax, smallpox, and other exotic bioweapons is insufficient and will fail. Beginning with the 9/11 attack, the war on terror triggered a tectonic shift in global security priorities and elephantine ripples in defense spending patterns across the globe as open democracies began shifting to a security state footing. The revival of U.S. government interest in germ warfare opened new opportunities. The U.S. biodefense budget went from $137 million in 1997 to $14.5 billion for 2001 through 2004. Every agency with a colorable claim to a national security function paddled out frantically to barrel the money tsunami. Between 2001 and 2014, the United States spent around $80 billion on biodefense. Since germ weaponry was still illegal, vaccines became a critical euphemism for the revival of the multi-billion dollar bioweapons industry. Pentagon sources told Science magazine that the military was applying for a sweeping overhaul of how the federal government develops vaccines to protect both the military and civilians. The Pentagon's assault on the vaccine space was both an opportunity and threat to Dr. Fauci and NIAID. U.S. Vice President Cheney and his PNAC Confederates found some convenient loopholes in the Geneva Convention through which they drove a 40-fold expansion in spending in biological weapons research. The Department of Defense had strict systems in place to ensure compliance with the Biological Weapons Convention. Those restrictions limited the Pentagon's freedom to undertake new research programs, particularly those referred to as the leading edge of biodefense. Cheney's response, recalls Professor Richard E. Bright, was to transfer this research from the Department of Defense to the National Institutes of Health, specifically to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. By about 2004, this transfer was complete, and NIAID had been transformed into an arm of the defense sector. This made the NIAID director, Anthony Fauci, a major player in biodefense and germ warfare. Dr. Fauci sharpened his elbows and began maneuvering for a leading role for NIAID in milking the BARDA Homeland Security's cash cows. NIAID's biosecurity budget went from $0 in 2000 to $1.7 billion after the 2001 anthrax letters, much of that for bioweapons vaccines. Within 5 months following the anthrax postal incidents, Dr. Fauci had created two new sub-agencies to capture his share of the cheese, the NIAID Strategic Plan for Biodefense Research and the NIAID Biodefense Research Agenda for CDC Category A agents, which were those microorganisms designated by CDC to be potential pandemic pathogens. To populate the sub-agencies, he assembled a cadre of his loyal deputies and infectious disease principal investigators from the HIV bonanza. Their mission was to brand contagions as pressing terror threats, drum up pandemic panic, and lobby for government support for NIAID's new battery of biodefense vaccinations. Dr. Fauci and the El-Hibris found common cause. Dr. Fauci could run interference for the El-Hibris at FDA, overriding regulatory anxieties about Bioport's laboratory and product safety. The El-Hibris, in turn, provided Dr. Fauci with a ready-made biodefense vaccine and a beachhead into the arcane maze of military contracting. Taking to the airwaves, Dr. Fauci made himself the face of biodefense. In a style now familiar to Americans, Fauci warned the public that postal workers who had handled the letters containing anthrax spores might still be harboring these in their lungs, even after taking 2 months of antibiotics, spreading plague with the morning mail. Taking the Elhibris vaccine prophylactically, Dr. Fauci advised, might help. Dr. Fauci's signature fear-mongering was, of course, his trademark science-free speculation. Nestling the Elhibris under his protective wing, Dr. Fauci swept aside FDA's safety concerns and publicly praised BioPort's experimental anthrax vaccine, BioThrax. He brushed aside the reservations of critics that the Elhibris never established BioThrax's safety with some of his prototypical dissembling. Dr. Fauci said, the vaccine is designed to get the immune system to recognize the proteins, and therefore the bacteria, and destroy both. In a December 2001 PBS interview, Fauci promised to deliver BioThrax, which had failed to pass a single FDA audit during the prior 4 years, at record pace. Fauci explained, in usual times, that is a process that takes years and years, but he committed that his project for delivering BioThrax is going to be markedly truncated because of the urgency of the situation. PBS observed that because of BioPort's production problems, the Pentagon had dramatically scaled back its plan to vaccinate U.S. forces, and there were insufficient anthrax vaccines in the Pentagon's stockpile to conduct the mass civilian inoculation program that had been Dr. Fauci's ultimate aim. But BioPort still possessed the only military contract, and Fouad El-Hibri announced that he was primed to ramp up production. Practically every veteran federal bureaucrat was jockeying to ride the war on terror into the high-stakes winner's circle. The military's medical corps, maneuvering for its share of the overflowing stream of bioterrorism funding, had proposed that each American soldier should receive 75 new vaccines upon enlistment to cover every potential bioweapon. The brass asked President Bush to finance the development of this inoculation fusillade. Not to be outgunned by the military doctors, Dr. Fauci announced in an October 2002 speech that within 10 years, his institute would produce a vaccine, a therapeutic drug, and an adjuvant drug for each of some 24 bioweapons diseases, such as plague and hemorrhagic fever. According to an article in Scientific American, one scientist who requested anonymity said that Dr. Fauci told him that the Bush administration had demanded this goal and that he accepted it to prevent the Department of Defense or the Department of Homeland Security from getting the job. Dr. Fauci was openly competing with the military in an escalating campaign to soak the taxpayers, using the risk posed by anthrax as a pretext. NIAID's biodefense budget alone increased sixfold between 2002 and 2003, from $270 million to $1.75 billion. When no further bioterror attacks occurred over the next 10 years, Dr. Fauci skillfully maintained his annual $1.7 billion biosecurity funding by deftly recalibrating his rhetoric away from bioterrorism hype. Instead, he invoked the new panic of natural but emerging infectious diseases. Dr. Fauci's pivot to conflate infectious disease with terrorism proved a milestone inflection point in the militarization of pandemic response and in overcoming the traditional revulsion among Western democracies, codified in the Nuremberg Charter against coercive medical interventions. Despite the fact that they collectively killed only 800 people globally, the SARS coronavirus outbreaks between 2002 and 2004 were therefore a godsend to Dr. Fauci. The NIAID director ignored the most compelling caveat from those incidents, the fact that coronavirus lab escapes in China, Taiwan, and Singapore had precipitated several of the outbreaks. Fauci boasted in 2011, through the anthrax response, we built both a physical and an intellectual infrastructure that can be used to respond to a broad range of emerging health threats. By that time, the escalating intramural arms race to capture Pentagon, CIA, BARDA, DARPA, and HHS biosecurity funding was pulling the military, CIA, and NIAID deeper and deeper into the dicey alchemy of gain-of-function research that would ultimately culminate inside the BSL-4 Pandora's box in Wuhan. The CIA dips in its toe. The CIA had a long, sordid history of secretly promoting the U.S. bioweapons program. One of the agency's first projects was establishing a network of so-called rat lines that Army intelligence officers used to smuggle some 1,600 chemicals and bioweapons and WMD experts, many of them Nazi Party kingpins and notorious war criminals, out of the reach of the Allies' Nuremberg prosecutors following World War II. The directors of a notorious operation, codenamed Paperclip, provided these researchers with new identities and put them to work developing U.S. germ warfare capacity at Fort Detrick and elsewhere even after 1972. As late as 1997, the CIA defied the Bioweapons Treaty to launch a top-secret and highly illegal effort to create a doomsday bacteria bomblet. The CIA officially made its open debut in the biosecurity racket in 2004 with its launch of Argus, a project that monitors biological, terrorist, and pandemic threats in 178 nations. CIA operative and pediatrician Jim Wilson set up the program at Georgetown University with funding from DHS and the Intelligence Innovation Center to create and implement global foreign biological event detection and tracking capability, capable of assessing millions of pieces of information about social behavior daily, and to train government officials in pandemic preparedness. One of the key figures in this global surveillance effort was CIA officer Dr. Michael Callahan. Dr. Michael Callahan is one of the biggest names in bioweapons research. Dr. Callahan ran a biosecurity program for the former CIA surrogate USAID before serving as director of DARPA's bioweapons research program. At DARPA, he competed to outdo NIH in laundering money through Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance to perform bioweapons research, including at the Wuhan lab. And as DARPA director, Callahan launched the PREDICT project in 2009, following Jeremy Ferrer's fake bird flu pandemic. PREDICT appeared to be a reincarnation of the CIA's Argus project under the cover of USAID. PREDICT is the largest single source of funding to Daszak, with a $3.4 million subgrant routed through the University of California 2015 to 2020. PREDICT became the largest funder of gain-of-function studies and served as the principal funding vehicle through which the gain-of-function cartel evaded Barack Obama's 2014 presidential moratorium, when, during the height of the presidential gain-of-function moratorium, Ralph Baric and the UTMB lab's Vineet Minichery brazenly published their alarming 2015 study describing their reckless experiments to breed pandemic bat coronaviruses that could spread via respiratory droplets in humanized mice. They omitted mentioning, in their initial online version of the article, that one of the funding sources was USAID EPT PREDICT. Apparently hoping to cover its tracks, PREDICT had laundered its grant through Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance. USAID's PREDICT program boasts that it has identified almost 1,000 new viruses, including a new strain of Ebola, and trained some 5,000 people. In October 2019, not long before COVID-19 emerged, USAID abruptly ceased funding PREDICT, a decision bemoaned by Daszak in the New York Times as definitely a loss. Callahan had a chummy relationship with Daszak, with whom he co-authored several articles, including throughout the gain-of-function moratorium. In April 2015, for example, the names of Michael V. Callahan and Peter Daszak appeared as co-authors on a paper published in the Virology Journal entitled Diversity of Coronavirus in Bats from Eastern Thailand. Callahan was well aware that he and his confederates were toying with fire. In 2005, Callahan testified before Congress as he was moving into his new office at DARPA. He concluded the hearing with a chilling warning about the nation's new commitment to Janus-faced gain-of-function science that Drs. Fauci, Robert Kadlec, Callahan himself, and many others would proceed to blithely ignore, quote, "the dark science of biological weapon design and manufacture parallels that of the health sciences and the cross-mixed disciplines of modern technology. Potential advances in biological weapon lethality will in part be the byproduct of peaceful scientific progress. So, until the time when there are no more terrorists, the U.S. government and the American people will depend on the scientific leaders of their field to identify any potential dark side aspect to every achievement," end quote. Even after leaving DARPA and USAID, Callahan periodically boasted of his continuing influence over U.S. pandemic response policies at the highest levels of government. He alluded to his confidence in these mysterious connections in 2012. "I still have federal responsibilities to the White House for pandemic preparedness and exotic disease outbreak, which will continue for the near future." On January 4, 2020, Callahan called Dr. Robert Malone from China just as the coronavirus began taking its first wave of casualties. Malone, a former contractor to the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases and the chief medical officer at Alchem Laboratories, is the inventor of the mRNA vaccine technology platform. Malone first met Callahan in 2009 through Malone's sometime business partner, Daryl Galloway, a CIA officer who formerly served in the U.S. Navy and at one point held the post of director of JSTO in the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. To Malone, Galloway introduced Callahan as a fellow CIA officer. During his January 4th phone call, Callahan told Malone that he was just outside Wuhan. Malone assumed that Callahan was visiting China under cover of his Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital appointments. Callahan told Malone that he had been treating hundreds of COVID-19 patients. Callahan subsequently described to National Geographic how he had pored through thousands of case studies at the outbreak's epicenter. He giddily reported his amazement at the virus's magnificent infectivity and its capacity to explode like a silent smart bomb in your community. Callahan later confessed to Malone that he lacked authority to be in Wuhan and had escaped by boat when the government imposed its quarantine. Callahan repeated parts of this story to Brendan Borrell, a writer for Science. Later, DTRA scientist Davis Hone, a GS-15 officer, warned Malone to stop talking about Callahan, saying that, "We had no military personnel in Wuhan at the time of the outbreak, and Michael was lying about his presence." Malone told me that would mean that Michael also lied to Brendan Borrell. On leaving China, Callahan returned to Washington to brief federal officials and then went directly to work as a special advisor to Robert Kadlec, managing the government's response to the coronavirus. Robert Kadlec as Bad Santa, the El Hibris Cash In. By 2011, Bioport was already profiting handsomely in the bioweapons vaccine space. After 9/11, President Bush, presumably at the urging of Secretary Rumsfeld, Robert Kadlec, and Dr. Fauci, whose advice he valued, had placed Bioport's Michigan lab under protection in the national interest. El Hibri and his son, gnawing on gristle prior to October 4th, began fattening themselves on NIAID and BARDA contracts. With friends like Fauci and Kadlec in high places, Bioport, which changed its name to Emergent BioSolutions in 2004 to escape its checkered past, was enjoying the first bright days of the charmed journey that would place the El Hibris among the elite army of COVID-19 nouveau billionaires in 2021. After 2001, Rumsfeld's Pentagon agreed to hike Bioport's compensation by 30%, from $3.35 in its 1998 contract to $4.70 per dose, and to purchase anthrax shots for 2.4 million members of the armed forces, each of whom the military would require to receive 6 doses over an 18-month period. That was $60 million worth of poorly performing and unapproved vaccines for a threat that never again surfaced. The anthrax threat was always phantasmagoric. Since anthrax does not spread through human-to-human transmission, terrorists plotting an anthrax epidemic would need to somehow simultaneously release spores over dozens of U.S. cities. The anthrax deal was exceptionally ridiculous, since antibiotics are a far safer, more elegant, and more useful defense against anthrax. The prescribed remedy, ciprofloxacin, is a cheap, commonly used antibiotic that Tony Fauci himself recommended after the 2001 postal incidents. The best approach toward anthrax is antimicrobial therapy, Dr. Fauci admitted to Congress in 2007. Indeed, the night of the 9/11 attacks, the White House Medical Office thoughtfully and presciently dispensed ciprofloxacin to select White House staff who were accompanying Dick Cheney to the safety of Camp David. Furthermore, the El Hibris anthrax jab was by far the worst of a bad lot. According to the Times, Emergent's anthrax vaccine was not the government's first choice. It was more than 30 years old and plagued by manufacturing challenges and complaints about side effects. Officials instead backed a company named VaxGen, which was developing a vaccine using newer technology licensed from the military. In 2004, the El Hibris co-founded, with their partner and former Joint Chiefs Chair Admiral William Crow, a lobbying group called the Alliance for Biosecurity as part of their strategy to secure lucrative BARDA-funded BioShield contracts and beat back upstart competitors like VaxGen. That lobbying group recruited two of the Johns Hopkins Center for Biosecurity spooks with whom Cadillac had written the Dark Winter simulation, Tara O'Toole and Colonel Randall Larson, and enlisted more than 50 lobbyists to successfully block VaxGen from muscling in on its locked-up anthrax government monopoly. With these sorts of friends in high places, Emergent made the National Strategic Stockpile an exclusive captive market. By 2006, VaxGen had lost its $800 million contract and was bankrupt, and Emergent remained the government's sole source monopoly. Emergent then purchased VaxGen's anthrax vaccine for $2 million at pennies on the dollar. A 2021 New York Times expose titled "How One Firm Put an Extraordinary Burden on the U.S.'s Troubled Stockpile" documented Emergent's airtight domination of stockpile purchases. As Emergent prospered, other companies working on pandemic remedies for the stockpile were squeezed out of government spending decisions. Several federal health officials anonymously told the Times that preparations for an outbreak like COVID-19 almost always took a backseat to Emergent's anthrax vaccines. By 2011, the El Hibris connections had put Emergent in the driver's seat. Despite its vaccine's glaring and dangerous deficiencies, Emergent received $107 million in 2010 from Cadillac's baby, BARDA, and up to $29 million from Fauci's NIAID to develop Nuthrax, its old anthrax vaccine with a new adjuvant, for large-scale manufacture in 2014. By 2010, Emergent's anthrax vaccine price had risen to about $28, now closer to $30 per dose, with 75% gross profit margin for the El Hibris. As with Biothrax, the El Hibris never performed functional safety testing for Nuthrax, and the FDA has never approved the vaccine. But BARDA recently contracted for $261 million of this experimental and notoriously dangerous unlicensed anthrax vaccine. By then, the company had grown from a single corporate office in Rockville, Maryland, to headquarters in Seattle, Munich, and Singapore. Its projects include developing vaccines for pandemic flu and tuberculosis in partnership with Oxford University and with funding from the Gates Foundation. Despite Nuthrax's failure to win FDA approval, almost half of the Strategic National Stockpile's $500 million annual budget prior to 2020 went to Emergent's two anthrax vaccines, a cost that, according to the New York Times, left the government with less money to buy supplies needed in a pandemic. Some guardian angels with invisible hands seemed to catch the El-Hibris every time they stumbled. In March 2021, two federal officials anonymously told the New York Times that one year the government increased its order of Emergent's main anthrax vaccine by $100 million after the company insisted it needed the additional sales to stay in business. At the time that order was announced in 2016, the federal vaccine stockpile reserve already had enough to vaccinate more than 10 million people. The stockpile has long been the company's biggest and most reliable customer for its anthrax vaccines, which expire and need to be replaced every few years. After that, the cards really started breaking for the El-Hibris. When Cadillac left the federal government, the El-Hibris did not forget the man who rescued them from bankruptcy and possibly from arrest. In the summer of 2012, Fouad El-Hibri made Robert Cadillac managing director and part owner of his own biodefense company, East West Protection. The company received Pentagon backing that year to build a U.S. biodefense site in Utah in partnership with the HHS. CEO Bob Kramer told Forbes it was designed to prevent a future pandemic. With El-Hibri financing, Cadillac founded a company, RPK Consulting, which provided consulting services to Emergent until 2015. The firm paid Cadillac $451,000 in 2014 alone. In 2015, the El-Hibris bought out Cadillac's shares of East West, allowing him to take the post of Deputy Staff Director for the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. 2 years later, President Donald Trump nominated Cadillac to become Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, ASPR, an office within Health and Human Services. During his confirmation process, Cadillac neglected to disclose his financial entanglements with the El-Hibris on the Senate nomination forms. The El-Hibris apparently anticipated a windfall for Emergent from Cadillac's new posting. In July 2017, 4 days after Cadillac's nomination, Emergent announced that it was acquiring the rights to the smallpox vaccine from Sanofi Pasteur, the government's previous supplier. On August 3rd, the Senate confirmed Cadillac, and sure enough, although the U.S. taxpayers were now paying his salary, Cadillac never really stopped working for the El-Hibris. And that year, Christmas arrived early for the Lebanese arms dealers. Immediately after his appointment, Cadillac maneuvered deftly to move management of the Strategic National Stockpile, which he had conceived and created, from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to his own office, giving him authority over all acquisitions for the $7 billion contents. As soon as Emergent completed its acquisition of the Sanofi smallpox jab, Cadillac moved to increase the government's stockpile of these worthless and dangerous vaccines. Sanofi Pasteur had been charging the stockpile $4.27 per dose and had 5 years remaining on a 10-year government contract worth about $425 million. The El-Hibris initially sought only a modest price increase, but Cadillac generously finalized a sweetheart deal with his friends and former business partners, doubling the 5-year term that the El-Hibris had requested to 10 years. Cadillac also doubled the number of doses per year, from 9 to 18 million, and gave the El-Hibris twice the price per dose that Sanofi received. Cadillac's new contract for the El-Hibris promised Emergent $9.44 per dose in the first year, with that figure rising annually throughout the contract term. In the end, Cadillac awarded the El-Hibris a 10-year, $2.8 billion no-bid contract to purchase their smallpox vaccines. The stockpile was already overflowing with smallpox vaccines in 2018. The CDC reported on its website in June 2019 and continues to say that the stockpile already had sufficient smallpox vaccine for every American. Cadillac explained that his large purchase was necessary to keep the production base warm, another way of saying to keep the El-Hibris fat. Cadillac wrapped his gift with a red ribbon, Cadillac's brazenly corrupt announcement that the stockpile would no longer fund Emergent's competitors. Emergent BioSolutions received more than $1.2 billion in contracts from Cadillac during the Trump years, with millions more coming from NIAID and DARPA. Cadillac's brassy approach inspired awestruck admiration within the pharmaceutical industry. In March 2020, President Donald Trump's HHS Secretary Alex Azar, former Eli Lilly president and pharma lobbyist, designated Cadillac to lead the department's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Cadillac's appointment was a signal to Big Pharma of the impending orgy of ransack, pillage, and plunder. Naturally, the El-Hibris would enjoy the king's share of booty. That same year, Cadillac invoked the emergency use authorization to purchase $370 million worth of the El-Hibris' licensed and unlicensed anthrax vaccines. 2020 was the year with the largest sales of Emergent's anthrax vaccines to date. After the FDA authorized Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use in February 2021, Cadillac pressured the pharmaceutical giant to sign a $480 million contract with the El-Hibris to perform the manufacturing of J&J's COVID-19 jabs. Forbes headlined, "Little-known publicly traded company given massive deal to manufacture one-shot COVID-19 vaccine." By June, Cadillac's BARDA upped the ante with another $628 million gift to Emergent BioSolutions for scaling up production of targeted vaccine candidates. Emergent signed separate deals worth hundreds of millions with AstraZeneca and Bill Gates's Novavax to manufacture vaccine doses at its Gaithersburg, Maryland factory. A March 7, 2021 New York Times expose about Emergent's crooked relationship with the government reported that $1 billion in payments to the company for anthrax and smallpox vaccines took up almost half the Strategic National Stockpile's budget. Emergent had become the number one vendor to the stockpile. To finance these windfalls for the El-Hibris, Cadillac needed to short other stockpile supplies. By the time the novel coronavirus emerged, the stockpile had only 12 million N95 respirators. Cadillac also scuttled an Obama-era initiative to spend a relatively trivial $35 million to build a machine that could produce 1.5 million N95 masks per day. To rationalize their inventory gaps, Cadillac pled poverty. The New York Times reported shocking shortfalls in protective gear for healthcare workers, ventilators, and masks, just as the COVID-19 crisis called for them. Well aware of the situation, Cadillac was unwilling to free up money by reducing the supply of anthrax vaccines. The El-Hibris' second sugar daddy, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was also raining down manna on Emergent. At the beginning of the pandemic, Emergent signed a development deal with NIAID for a plasma-derived therapy. Dr. Fauci aimed to incorporate the company's COVID-HIG product into one of NIAID's clinical studies, with initial funding of $14.5 million coming from Cadlec through BARDA. In turn, Cadlec supported Dr. Fauci's pet project Moderna, the mRNA jab caper that Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates considered their holy grail. In mid-April 2020, Cadlec arranged for BARDA to provide Moderna up to $483 million to accelerate the Fauci-Gates vaccine's development and manufacturing. That amounted to about half of what BARDA doled out to all of Moderna's competitors combined, including Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and AstraZeneca. Cadlec was also generous to Bill Gates, arranging a $1.6 billion grant, the largest to date, from Operation Warp Speed to Gates's biotech selection, Novavax. Although the company, based in Gaithersburg, Maryland, had never brought a vaccine to market in its 33-year history and was then on the verge of collapse, Gates and his obedient minions at the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, CEPI, had placed a bet on Novavax's technology, which uses moth cells to pump out crucial molecules at a faster rate than typical vaccines. Cadlec's generosity with his warp speed wampum caused Novavax's stock to surge 30%. John J. Trizzino, Novavax's chief business and financial officer, said the company did nothing inappropriate but acknowledged that it used its connections to Gates to help win the deals. In September 2019, less than a month before COVID began circulating, the Gates Foundation made a $55 million pre-IPO equity investment in BioNTech. The company also had never brought a single product to market. Soon afterward, the German government followed Gates with a $445 million infusion into BioNTech. On July 21, 2020, when Robert Cadlec committed Operation Warp Speed to a $2 billion purchase of 100 million doses of BioNTech Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, the company's stock value soared, with Bill Gates's equity shares increasing to an evaluation of $1.1 billion. In October 2020, Emergent became one of four companies collaborating on a clinical trial for a combination treatment regimen that included Dr. Fauci's drug remdesivir as a background therapy. The company said in a statement, "Emergent is proud to continue our partnership with NIAID, NIH, and BARDA to advance potential therapeutic solutions for COVID-19 in hospitalized patients." Bill Gates owned a large stake in remdesivir's manufacturer, Gilead. WHO's own studies showed clearly, as even WHO acknowledged, that remdesivir was useless against COVID. Worse, the drug's extreme toxicity, remdesivir's side effects mimic the late-stage symptoms of COVID, may actually aggravate the severity of the illness. To overcome these obstacles, Dr. Fauci financed and rigged a suite of flawed studies to suggest, deceptively, that remdesivir might slightly reduce the number of days a patient would stay in the hospital. The WHO's much larger studies proved that there was no reduction in length of hospital stay. Nevertheless, using his blatantly orchestrated research, Dr. Fauci then forced remdesivir's approval through FDA as standard of care for COVID. At the same time, Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates were financing and promoting studies to discredit chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine and sabotage ivermectin, two effective COVID remedies that posed an existential threat to remdesivir and the entire Fauci-Gates COVID vaccine enterprise. Emergent's CEO, Robert Kramer, boasted to Wall Street analysts in February 2021 that the year had been the strongest year in our 22-year history. The New York Times reported that Emergent's stock had reached such a zenith that Fuad El-Hibri cashed in shares and options worth over $42 million more than he had redeemed in the previous 5 years combined. When in April 2021, Emergent BioSolutions ruined 15 million Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines due to quality control mishaps at its poorly managed Baltimore production facility, Congress launched an investigation into whether Emergent used high-level connections to get billions of dollars in federal contracts despite a history of failing to deliver satisfactorily on its contracts. Congressional investigators also raised concerns about Emergent's inadequate staff training, persistent quality control issues, and the company stiffing the government with an unjustified 800% price increase for its anthrax vaccine. The Democratic chairs of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform and Select Oversight Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis focused their inquiry on Cadillac's role. In a letter, the committee chairs complained that Cadillac appears to have pushed for the $628 million award to Emergent to develop a COVID vaccine factory, despite indications that Emergent did not have the ability to reliably fulfill the contract. As the top dog among the COVID-19 pandemic's government managers, Cadillac had promoted Emergent as the United States' primary vaccine manufacturing facility. In April 2021, The Times published another extensive exposé reporting that Emergent had not yet been able to produce a single acceptable dose of any COVID-19 vaccine. Following exposés in the New York Times and the Washington Post, J&J took over the production at that plant. The FDA stepped in after inspecting the facility and ordered Emergent to halt all production of materials for COVID-19 vaccines pending a review and remediation, and to quarantine all existing materials. HHS ordered Emergent to discard millions of contaminated doses. Instead, in March 2021, the company shipped millions of doses of its defective vaccines to Canada, Europe, South Africa, and Mexico. The House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis held a hearing on May 19, 2021, and ordered Emergent to turn over all its federal contracts since 2015 and all communications with Robert Cadillac. Emergent's political invincibility left the company unbowed by all those scandals. In July 2020, Emergent announced a 5-year, $450 million deal to manufacture COVID drugs for Johnson & Johnson. In February 2021, HHS awarded Emergent another contract, this one worth up to $22 million, to develop a COVID-19 therapy. Atlantic Storm 2003-2005. In January of 2003, and again in 2005, a cabal of U.S. and European military, intelligence, and medical officials germ-gamed another exercise they called Atlantic Storm. Thomas V. Inglesby and the Spooks, Tara O'Toole and Colonel Randall J. Larson, were the simulation's principal authors. Both the 1999 HHS smallpox simulation and the June 2001 Dark Winter smallpox simulation focused ominously not on public health, but on the quandary of how to impose control over U.S. and global populations during public health emergencies, how to sweep away civil rights and impose mass obedience to military and medical technocrats. Atlantic Storm further probed these sinister disquisitions. High-level government figures, including Madeleine Albright playing the President of the United States and WHO Director General Gro Harlem Brundtland playing herself, hosted a summit of transatlantic military and intelligence agency planners coordinating responses after a radical terrorist band unleashes smallpox. According to the After Action Report, the key issues for summit principals were coping with scarcity of critical medical resources such as vaccines, and assuring a uniform coordinated response among all governments in the world. The simulation stressed the inadequacy of current multilateral frameworks like NATO and the EU to cope with social, economic, and political disruption from an international epidemic, be it natural or the result of a bioterrorist attack, and emphasize the importance of developing systems to coordinate global lockstep security protocols that went beyond just stockpiling vaccines or training more doctors. Characteristically, the assembled eminences bypassed any discussion of bolstering people's immune system response or testing and distributing off-label therapeutics, and went directly to recommending militarized strategies including police state controls, mass propaganda and censorship, and the suspension of civil rights and due process rulemaking in favor of diktats by health authorities, all aimed at coercive vaccination of the population. These scenarios, which health officials and spooks conceived of and gamed back in 2005, became our collective reality in 2020 and 2021. Global Mercury 2003. Between September 8th and 10th of that same year, the spooks at the U.S. State Department Office of the Coordinator for Counterterrorism organized another scenario exercise dubbed Global Mercury with the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, the WHO, and the Department of State. Over a 56-hour period, public health technocrats coordinated communications and lockstep response between trusted agents from the GHSAG nations, the United States, the UK, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Mexico, during a simulated outbreak after self-inoculated terrorists spread smallpox to countries around the world. The SCL Simulation 2005. Atlantic Storm and Global Mercury were additional loud notes amplifying persistent Pentagon signals that biosecurity was the emerging growth sector for national defense. In response to such toxins, private military contractors began thronging to the pandemic surveillance and psyops sector like hogs to a corn crib. Long before Robert Mercer, with his daughter Rebecca, became Donald Trump's biggest private donors, and before they launched the right-wing social media platform Parler, he created the first private sector provider of psychological warfare services in 1993. The Mercer's Strategic Communication Laboratories, SCL Group, was the parent company to the notorious data-manipulating firm Cambridge Analytica. This brand-new psyops firm, headquartered in the UK, drew some of the largest crowds in 2005 when it set up a high-tech propaganda ops center at the UK's annual military technology showcase. As a contemporary article in Slate described the SCL simulation, classic signs of smallpox are threatening a pandemic of epic proportions when a shadowy media firm steps in to help orchestrate a sophisticated campaign of mass deception. SCL takes on the task of convincing the entire country's population to comply with lockdown rules by inventing a lie about an unleashed cloud of toxic chemicals. The mission's objective is to prevent mass panic and casualties from the classified threat of smallpox. SCL feeds disinformation to the press and manufactures medical data. Londoners stay indoors, convinced that even a short walk into the streets could be fatal. The article continues, "If SCL weren't so earnest, it might actually seem to be mocking itself, or perhaps George Orwell. At the end of the smallpox scenario, dramatic music fades out to a taped message urging buyers to embrace strategic communications, which it describes as the most powerful weapon in the world. What makes SCL's strategy so unusual is that it proposes to propagate its campaign domestically, at least some of the time, and rather than influence just opinion, it wants people to take a particular course of action. The company based its psyops strategies on propaganda techniques developed by a virtual lab called the Behavioral Dynamics Institute, run out of Leeds University by Professor Phil Taylor, a consultant to UK and American defense agencies until his death at 56 in 2010. The article identified SCL only as funded by private investors. Company chief Nigel Oakes described its nefarious skullduggery as mind-bending for political purposes. In a March 20, 2018 interview with Yahoo Finance, Oakes described himself as a man without much of an ethical radar. According to SCL's public affairs director Mark Broughton, basically we're launching ourselves on the defense market and homeland security market at the same time. Aware that the company might face criticism over its promotion of totalitarian security states, Broughton emphasized to Slate the company's role in saving lives. "There is some altruism in it," he said grudgingly, "but we also want to earn money."